Good morning. Good morning. Wake up HCC, or though it's really Hoka Live now.
Yeah, Hoka Live. We gotta get used to that. Gotta make that adjustment.
I do. I have to get used to that. That name adjustment is just so it's different. It's been Wake Up HCC for the longest time, and it's just not setting in my mind yet. But this is Hoka Live.
Yeah.
And live we are this morning.
But are we awake though?
But I don't know about that, but we're live. Yeah. I know that.
I don't think anyone was waking up anyway, so maybe it's good that we changed, you know, the title, the wake up. No one was waking up when we
Nobody was waking up.
No one was waking up.
I don't know. I think I feel pretty awake, generally speaking. At least a little more awake than you are, for sure.
Yeah, that's for sure.
That's for sure.
It's kind of the default.
Right. So this morning we have a special guest. He's a friend of our station now. I think I'm going to call you a friend of our station. It's a second appearance here in our studio. And
a two-timer.
Yeah. And the first time, you know, you came and you talked to us about the Alpha Achievers and what you guys do here in Howard County and your organization. And we had a wonderful conversation surrounding that and the great work that you guys do to inspire teenage boys specifically, right, in our community to be better. And then you reached out to me and you told me about this book that you wrote, a memoir that just very candidly talks about your life and what it was like for you growing up. And to me, it kind of like brought it all together, because by reading your story, by reading your memoir and putting it together with the work with the kids that you do right now, it's like it just painted the whole picture for me. So David Hugo Barrett is our guest this morning, and we're going to talk about his book, A Newark Childhood, a Memoir. Welcome to our studio.
Thank you very much. Good to be back.
Yes, very good to have you back. And, you know, we were just before we came into the studio this morning, you were saying, I was telling you, I want my daughter to read this book. And you were like, ooh, this is really a boy's book. And it really is. I mean, it really is. It really is your perspective of the world and of this teenage boy who is very curious and it's just trying to figure things out, right? As things present themselves and trying to make the right decision versus the wrong decision, and you know, seeing how many times you had this opportunities and this different situations really where you had to decide. Right? And many times you made this decision that wasn't the best one.
This is true.
Or you were, and you were, but you know, it's like fate was always on your side. And so many times throughout the book, there's like, you're making the decision, right? You're encountered with a situation. There's one where you're in a store and you went with your friends and you guys were going to take things that were not yours and we're not going to pay for them, right? Just being rebels.
Save the money.
Right? Exactly. And, but then you decided not to, right? You decided not to. Your friends did go with the plan. You did not go through with it, but you all three got in trouble for it. And right?
Yes.
And it's situations like this, and what I loved about your memoir and what I loved about the way you describe things is you could really see the process, you know, of this boy who is encountered with this different situations. Like, well, but I was saving money, as mm-hmm. you just said, right? I mean, that was because I could use that money for other things, right?
Yes.
I didn't have to pay for that. But when you were encountered with the situation, that voice inside of you was like, no, don't do it. You're going to get in trouble. You still got in trouble even though you didn't do anything. You try to stand up for yourself, right, and mm-hmm. say, I didn't do anything. I still should not get in trouble. Mm-hmm. Yet you felt that fear. So it's like all of those emotions are painted so clearly in your book, which is just beautiful because it really shows what a teenage boy feels and it's faced with, you know, on a daily basis. And I have a 12-year-old boy.
Oh, good for you.
And
perfect
I think,
age.
I think you were right around that age,
yes, this
right?
Is
when
right.
this was happening.
Sixth
so,
grade.
Exactly. So I was thinking about those things. So where did your inspiration come from? What was your goal, you know, when you were writing this book and you were going, because I mean, I have to say, usually you read a book, you know, that tells a story of somebody and they're either passed away or something like that. So there's no judgment, I think. Mm-hmm. But here you're very open, very free. And I mean, you're putting yourself very vulnerable out there, right? For your friends, for your family. Like I was, as I was reading, I was also thinking, I wonder if he still talks to these people and, you know, what they think about him telling their secrets also kind of thing here. So what was your inspiration? What made you be so open about it?
Well, curiously enough, this book started out as a poem that I decided to write as a tribute to my mother for her demonstration of courage in front of me. So I wanted to, in a poem, I wanted to describe how proud I was that she was able to stand up for herself. And so that's how it started. But the poem, I kept writing and writing and writing, and suddenly the poem was gone or put on the side, and it became this came this book. And then I thought, well, I'll write this book, and then I'll let my sons read it, and perhaps they'll get some idea of what kinds of things they're going to face with their children, because my sons were adult by the time I started, and certainly when I finished it. They not only were the adults, but my youngest son had a child. Mm. Make it my fifth grandchild and my second granddaughter.
And she's here in studio right now.
And cooperating so far. Cooperating,
doing very well, yes. And so, and that's what I was thinking. That's exactly what I was thinking. I'm like, you have your family with you. And I mean, there's certain pillars clearly strong that played really strong on bringing you up, right?
Yes.
Your mom's definitely a figure. And now that you say that, I can definitely see, because there's many times throughout the book where I think you mentioned on there that there's only two times or three times where you saw her like really stand up for herself against white men, mm-hmm. right? And that's one of the things that comes really strongly through the book. So the race, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Race was one of the things that definitely defined you. Mm-hmm. Religion mm-hmm. was another one. Education mm-hmm. was another one. And I'm going to call it curiosity, right?
Okay,
in many different aspects, you know, I mean, there was obviously the sexual aspect, but also like we were saying, you know, the shoplifting. And, you know, it was kind of like you were just curious about what would happen here. And that curiosity kind of drove you to make certain decisions. And you know, like when you talked about the gang fights and how you wanted to be part of it, but at the same time, you were like, maybe not such a good idea. Right?
Yes, this is true. All this is, so far, you've been very perceptive. That's correct.
So so let's talk about this a little bit more in detail, about those pillars that I found through the book. Mm-hmm. One that comes from the beginning is education. And it keeps growing on you, because at first it's like, first you explained that in your first school, you were always the kid who had the right answers and who would bring the books, but you were ridiculed for that, mm-hmm. right? What kept you going? Because it's very easy to see how a child who might be like you trying to bring the smarts into the group, right, and being pushed back a little bit because of it, could just give away, right, and be like, I don't want to be ridiculed anymore. I just want to be part of the group, so I'm just going to forget the books. So what was that drive? What kept you going, you know, to keep education such in the forefront of your life?
Well, there are two forces in the form of people. The first one, of course, was my mother. Mm-hmm. And the second one was her youngest brother, after whom I get my middle name. His mm-hmm. first name was Hugo. So when we would visit them, he would always talk about, well, first thing he would say, how's school? That would be the first thing out of his mind. So then I'd have to have a reason, good reason, to want to share that information. I was proud that I was doing very well. I didn't share with him, however, that I was under constant harassment from my so-called friends for being a good student and excelling. The irony of that was that when it came time for them to do their homework, then people would literally, like, I'm a resource now suddenly, but it's so my intellectual prowess was not a problem then, except when they needed me to help them with their work.
Yeah.
And the first was my mother, who, you know, with whom I lived, of course. My uncle was in Portsmouth, Virginia, so I would see him maybe once a year, maybe once every other year when I visited my grandparents. And again, he would always say, hey, how's school, Hugo? No, he called me namesake. How's school, namesake? So that flattered me that he would recognize that. Mm. And in the book, I talk about how important it was to my life, I mean literally, when apparently my mother, after her, I would have been her fourth child. And so after she found out she was pregnant, she became concerned about how we're going to be able to afford another child. And so she called him from the payphone in our area and asked the question. And he said, well, if it's a boy, name him Hugo. I didn't learn this story until I was probably in my late 30s when he told me that story. And I could see why he wouldn't have told me earlier. Mm. But he just, this is a conversation. And I said, wow, that's deep. I said, thanks, Uncle.
And so education is, it's a big force. And I think hand in hand comes religion, which I found really interesting because you were exposed to science and religion together, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Tell us a little more because it was, and that was also defining as you talk about in your book, because your friends did not belong. So that was like defining and challenging at the same time, mm-hmm. right? Because the religion that you belonged to for a very long period of time mm-hmm. was different to what your friends were doing.
Totally opposite.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Totally opposite. It was, you know, looking back on it, I thought of it as an intellectual's religion.
Right,
there's a lot of reading that we're required to do even in Sunday school, which is school that, and I thought everyone knew what Sunday school was, but my editor saw the term in the book. He said, Sunday school? Question mark. So then I realized that not everybody had all churches didn't have Sunday schools. Mm-hmm. And we had a lesson every day to read from books that were supplied and an outline of what we're supposed to read. Monday through Saturday. Then on Sunday, we show up for class and we discuss what we read, like we're led by a teacher. And for the entire time that I was in that church as a child, my Sunday school teacher was a man, two men, Augie Peterson, who had gone to school in New Jersey, Stevens Tech, and then the other guy, Mr. Dreyfus. I forget where he went by. I know he dressed very nicely. So we had two men here. And I think the class, we had one girl. And I think we stayed together up through high school until we graduated. So my mother is the one who introduced the Christian Science faith to us because her conversion, when her mother was, she believes, cured of whatever disease she had. And so she became convinced that this was the religion for me. And so she passed it on to us. But my younger brother and I were the ones who was under whom influence we still were. So she required us to go to church every Sunday mm-hmm. with her. She'd drop us off. We'd go to the basement where the church Sunday school was, and she'd go upstairs, and it lasted exactly 1 hour, 11 to 12. At 12 o'clock, that boy was over. You know, I liked about that part.
Yes, it was 1 hour,
some of the
other
churches gone to, we know no time what time you get out, unless you had gone to an early morning service, which means that then he has to be finished by a certain time so he can get the second service. So I was grateful for that because I didn't like to be held in church for a long, long time.
But you also talk about how, you know, as you were trying to connect with your friends, music was important and how that was like a void almost through this religion.
Yes.
But also created opportunity for you to still kind of like relate to different religions. Mm-hmm. So how did that impact?
Well, I can't recall when I started, but I guess maybe around 11 or 12. We're all being introduced to R&B, becoming aware of it anyway. Mm-hmm. And I liked the music so much that I wanted to recreate it myself with my own voice and the voices of my friends. So I formed this group. I don't know what we called it. But one of the guys in the group, who was our second tenor, belonged to Mount Zion Baptist Church in Newark. And he invited my brother and me to join the youth choir. I said, how can I do that? We don't go to your church. He said, just come. Let me worry about it. So we went, and it was Wednesday night, so we'd meet at 6:30, I think it was. And that was the first time that I'd heard such rich music live. My mother would listen to it on the radio, but this is an opportunity that we actually create these songs. Well, not create them, but we could sing these songs ourselves. We could experiment with the harmony and meet some new people. Mm-hmm. But when it came time to perform, we couldn't show up because we had to go someplace else. And so the choir director asked Bubby was his nickname, what's with your friends? They don't come to, he said, well, they don't go to our church. He said, well, if they don't go to the church, we can't have them in the choir.
Right.
So I was exited out of the choir, but I still came to watch and listen. So I think that was perhaps my first introduction, if you will, to that kind of music personally. I heard it, again, as I said, I heard it on the radio. But being in person, it was just different. And I experimented with harmony, and that's when I realized what harmony was, and I knew I had the talent to harmonize. You know, I could do that, and everyone I surrounded myself with was like that. So the music got inside of me very, very early.
Mm-hmm. And throughout all of these facets, and throughout all of this time, and as you're telling your story, the one card that continuously plays is the race card. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it presents itself in many different ways, and it even evolves in my eyes, at least a little bit, because at first it was kind of like Italians versus the black kids of the neighborhoods, right? But then as you move on and you go into other opportunities in life, you realize that it was more of a white and black, but within the white there was even like different groups, as you mentioned. Yes. Right. Yes. And so how did that affect you? Because I know you also have a big contrast there with your uncle, and you tell a story about how his, you know, first reaction to having a white teacher was so different to yours having a white teacher. And how did that, you know, come into play and affect everything?
Well, I let my uncle read a first draft of the first chapter. Mm-hmm. And he wrote back and said, "My gosh," he said, your experience is very much like mine, and that it wasn't. He said, because being in the South, my mother, he said his mother and her mother had warned him as a boy to avoid contact with white women, white girls, because you'd get in trouble, serious trouble. Right. And I know, you know how many times they said that, but they were quite serious. It stuck with him. So when I wrote this, he read my experience in kindergarten. He explained that the teacher who was going to be his first kindergarten teacher was she thought she was white. Nellie Boyd was her name. And he was terrified that his mother would have his older sister take him to a place where the people, he should say, would harm him.
Right.
And so he just wouldn't settle. See, my mother had to take him out and take her to her one-room schoolhouse down the road a piece. And then when she got home with him, she explained what had happened. And then they made it clear to everybody who was white doesn't look, look white. So right. She said, "No, what does a five-year-old kid do with that stuff?" You know.
Right.
So that was his experience. My experience was that I was taken to school by the same person, but this time she's my mother, not his sister. I thought she was going to stay with me, but it became clear as she moved toward the door that she was going to be leaving. So right. I just, oh no, I'm going to be left alone. But my teacher, no tall and white, but I had no warnings of fear of what could happen. And I just fell in love with her. You know, she was tall, had this beautiful blonde hair, and she smelled like, you know, she smelled good. She was very comforting. She played the piano. She sang. And that's I felt very comfortable in that that environment. Had classmates who were friendly. As I say in the book, my world expanded beyond the kids in my neighborhood. And I saw other kids, you know, who had different perspectives and different ideas about life for children. And it just helped me grow a little bit. So by the time the day was over, I was very comfortable just that one day in that classroom.
So, you know, and as you continue to progress, though, but you continue to encounter some, challenges, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's the best word that I can say. But you continue to thrive through that. And you talk in your book, you're like, you know, I was there and I was comfortable being in that environment, but it's also like you knew your limits. Like when you're going into college towards the end of the book, you say that you just immediately decided to go to the back of the bus because you weren't sure if the laws had already changed in the different states that you were going to ride through. Mm-hmm. And you didn't want to be embarrassed by that, right? Having been called out later to tell you to go to the back of the bus. Mm-hmm. So As you've grown and as you've continued to, you know, move and you've seen society change, I mean, what likeness or what differences do you see, you know, that continue to maybe affect you today? Because there's some deep, you know, I mean, at one point you said, I forget exactly what happened, but you said that if any white man ever came to try to harm your kids, you knew that you were going to do whatever it takes, right, to get back at them. So it's clear that there's some deep feelings in there because of all the experiences that you had. But at the same time, as you continue to grow, there's also deeper understanding and, you know, like a different view that comes into place.
Yes, well, there were two incidents. Riding my bicycle in my neighborhood, the first time it happened, I was riding in the street in the wrong way on a one-way street.
Yes.
So I could see the cars coming. That was my justification for that, a rationalization rather for that. And at one point, this car approached, and the man who was the driver put his hand out and slapped me and said, "Get out of the street, you black bastard." And I fell to the ground, glasses went down. I said, what did I do? What did I do?
Right.
So I went home and told my mom about it, and she said, "Well, you're not supposed to be riding in the street anyway." And I said, "Okay, fine." So the next time, and I can't recall what the time between the two, I was riding on the sidewalk, and I was making a right turn into oncoming pedestrian traffic. And these two white guys were walking, and one of them grabbed the handlebars of my bicycle and threw me in the bicycle into the street, into what would have been oncoming traffic, except mm-hmm. the light was red for the traffic, so that didn't happen. I lay there crying and said, nobody sought to help me or offered assistance. And it was lunchtime for them. So there were a lot of people out there in our neighborhood. And so then at that point, I said, you know, when I grow up, if I have children, and a white man even looks wrongly at him, I'm going to kill him, is what right. I said. And then I buried that over the years. I buried that in my consciousness. And it took actually some therapy to have that come to the surface as a reason. Because even as an adult, there was an incident at a cross-country meet with one of my sons where I was trying to get view of the kids coming over the hill. Mm-hmm. And as I stepped forward, this guy was standing in front of me, put his elbow out, so I thought, to block my movement. And so I thought it was just an accident. And so then I tried to move again, and he did the same thing. I said, "Man, would you please watch your elbow?" And he didn't say anything. Then he did it again. And when he did it again, then I just hauled off and popped him. And next thing I know, we're both rolling down the hill like two cowboys in a Western. And people were around us trying to break up the fight. And my glasses had gotten lost in the scuffle. And I had very nearsighted at the time, and I couldn't see very well. But right. So I was swinging at anything that appeared to be white, didn't care what it was or who it was. Because in that moment, they were my enemy. And the coach of the team finally got my attention and pulled me apart. And so I said, "Okay." And then the guy's wife and children were crying and said, "Oh my gosh, what are you doing to her husband?" You know, and I was all, because I was fine. So we stayed at the track meet, we're at home, and my wife saw the condition of my running suit and my glasses, different glasses. Said, "What happened? What?" I said, "I got into a fight." She said, "A fight? You got into a fight? You should be ashamed of yourself. You should be ashamed of yourself." And of course, I wasn't. You know,
right.
I said, "Well, what else could I have done?" is what I said to her. So there were some more instances like that once I got into the work world. And she said that I was acting out of proportion to what had occurred. And mm-hmm. I didn't know why it was. And finally, this came out in a therapy session. And then once I was able to identify the reason for the deep-seated feelings, then I could better manage them.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm really glad that you're sharing that, because I'm sure that, you know, there's a lot of people out there who have hurt feelings. I mean, we've all encountered mm-hmm. situations in life, right, where they deeply affect us. Whether we accept that or not, I think that's the key, right? Because
sure.
as you just mentioned, it does. It does affect you, and it does affect how you behave and how you react in certain situations if you don't know, if you haven't really looked at them and heal them, right?
Yeah, and then people who, for whatever reason, don't get that support they need from a therapist, just take it through life, mm-hmm. you know, and then they get into trouble themselves and they have no idea what happened. Why don't you understand why I did this? Why don't you understand that?
Right.
I know it was against the law, but heck, you know, he did so-and-so-and-so-and-so. But I think, so in the book, I speculate as to how did these men raise a family with the attitude they have towards me? And I know it wasn't personal. I realized that.
Right.
I said, so what kind of children did they have? Were they teach their children? Were their children's children teaching their children? All these are some projecting into the future as I see how this particular incident affected my own behavior.
And so, you know, looking at the future and the generations to come and, you know, where we are today, and you have your children and you have grandchildren, as you write this book, what are you hoping that they will see and that they will maybe take from that?
Well, all of my children at this point in time are parents themselves.
Mm-hmm.
The oldest one has a 17-year-old who's going to be going to college in the fall, next fall. So for them, it's how they're going to raise their children, because they're past that point in their lives. But also, they may have some deep-seated things that they haven't, they're not in touch with themselves, mm-hmm. and may cause them to reflect on their own lives when they see that part of it. So I'm hoping that that parents will see that their little boys are not just their little boys. There are other things going on, and they don't. And parents may not always know that or understand the reason for it. So it'll give them an opportunity to question and maybe to go a little deeper into their own children when they ask questions about certain things. And I think important thing is they get their, we call it sex education today. Mm-hmm. But I never got that talk from my parents. What I learned on the street. I learned from older boys who were just who you knew always telling the truth because you respected them only because they were older. And right. Because they were older, you knew they knew more than you did. And of course, right. They could beat you up. That's where I got my education about sex was right. From the guys on the street in right. The neighborhood, older guys. And I found out many years later they were not quite on point.
There were some things that were a little messy there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, going back to the alpha achievers, right, and, mm-hmm. and going back to the work that you do to inspire the newer generations today, based on your experiences and based on everything that you've done and the book that you've written, how do you take that even farther? And you know, what are you trying to instill, I guess, and your message to these generations?
Well, growing up is hard. When I was growing up, it's harder now. Mm. There are more distractions for young people. I taught after I retired the first time. I taught for 12 years in Howard County's alternative school, the Homewood Center. And I saw just how deeply they were tied to electronics, mm-hmm. digital media, no pun intended, yeah. that were distractions to them. Now, all I had was movies that I could walk by on the way to class. It's called the Little Theater, which is for adult films only. And I said, I can't wait till I'm adult so I can go to that theater. And I never went when I turned 8. I wanted to be able to drink, so I couldn't wait till I was 21. And I turned 21. It was no big deal. Mm-hmm. You know. So there are these things that hold out for you. It's forbidden. And because they're forbidden, you want to participate in them. But for to your point or to your question, I just think that it's important that young men realize that there are always options. Many, many options. And for the kids today, many more than I had. And that if there's someone or something in your life that's trying to get through to you and say, there's options 1, 2, 5. One is a good one for you. 3, 2 isn't questionable. 3, 4, 5 are definitely not what you want to do. And that they have the critical analysis, critical thinking skills to make those distinctions sometimes in the moment. Mm-hmm. Not just you contemplate them, but in the moment you have to make those kinds of decisions. And for me, my mother's voice is always in my head and still is now. And my uncle, of course, calling me when I was absent for a while from my family for 7 or 8 years and I finally showed up again. And my cousins with whom I had gone very close, to whom I'd come very close, said, what does it look like? And my uncle said, he's a handsome devil like his dad, like his uncle. but anyway, so my uncle and my mother, I think. So if they have an influence on their life that is trying to talk some sense into their heads, as my mother would say, then they have a chance. But there's no one whom they know, and particularly someone they know. It can't be on television. It can't be a rap star who you never have access to and who's not the real person you see. Mm-hmm. We're finding out they have flaws themselves, just like the rest of us. So I think that's important. And that becomes the intervention that I think all of us need and could benefit from.
Absolutely. So your book was released yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's called A Newer Childhood and Memoir. I'm going to show it right here on our camera. We are just about out of time and wrapping up our conversation up today. But if we can just remind everybody where they can get your book so that they can get familiar with it.
They can get it on Amazon or .com or BarnesandNoble.com or my website, which is DavidHugoBarrett.com. DavidHugoBarrett.com, and they can order it from any of those three choices, those three sources, if you will. And I'd be happy if they did.
Yeah, it's a very easy read. It's very easy to follow. It's very entertaining. Very, very entertaining. It's very candid. It's really, you know, as a parent, as I was telling you before, I appreciate it. And I not only want my son to read it, but I want my daughter to read it because it gives her that perspective of this is what happens in the boy's mind, which mm-hmm. I know she's going through her own things as a girl, mm-hmm. but it's just so open. It's just so open. It's just so honest. I really enjoyed it. So thank you for writing it. It gave me perspective, like I said, and it gave me awareness of what to expect with my son. So.
Right. I didn't tell everything. I even have some limits and guardrails.
Thank you for joining us this morning. I really appreciate it. And thank you everybody for watching and for listening. We'll be back on Wednesday. Have a wonderful Monday.
Have a good one, guys.
connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.